You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we take a listen to the new Barons and Gruel album, Dive Bar Dinner, with songs handcrafted for Wisconsin and the Midwest. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a Christmas in Wisconsin that went on to change many lives.
Media mogul Oprah Winfrey is known for so many things. There's her long-running talk show, her own network, and of course, the massive giveaways. Oprah's philanthropy extends far beyond TV show giveaways, and that deep need to give back was inspired by a moment in Milwaukee. Writer Dean Robbins takes us back to Oprah's best Christmas. A note to listeners, the story mentions abuse and suicide.
Before television stardom, Oprah Winfrey suffered a rough childhood in Milwaukee, marred by poverty and abuse. And yet, at age 12, she experienced what she called her best Christmas at an apartment on North 10th Street, a miraculous event that set her on a path toward healing. Winfrey grew up wearing potato sack dresses in rural Mississippi. She moved to Milwaukee at age 6 to live with her mother, who barely made ends meet as a housemaid. The troubled child experienced sexual assault, got pregnant at 14, lost the baby, and even contemplated taking her own life. In the midst of this nightmare, Winfrey had her transformative Christmas. It started on a bleak note when her mother canceled the family celebration in 1966 due to lack of funds. Here's how she described it years later on a 2003 episode of The Oprah Winfrey Show.
I remember feeling like it's going to be really hard on Christmas morning to go outside. Everybody had, you know, you go outside with your toys. What am I going to do when everybody else is outside?
Just as despair set in, three nuns on a charitable mission knocked on the apartment door. They surprised the family by handing out toys to Oprah and her siblings, as well as providing a turkey for Christmas dinner.
That was the best Christmas of my life because somebody remembered and I wasn't going to have to be the kid that said I got nothing.
The memory stuck with Winfrey as she turned her life around in high school. Sent to live with her father in Nashville, she earned good grades, worked at a radio station, and won a college scholarship. At 19, she became Nashville's first African-American TV news anchor, then moved on to a Baltimore newscast.
This is Eyewitness News, Maryland's most complete television news service, with Oprah Winfrey and the Eyewitness News team.
Winfrey was off and running. In 1986, her daytime talk show began airing nationally.
Hi, audience. Nice to see you.
With a down-to-earth persona and a dedication to personal growth, she quickly ascended to the American A-list. Businesswoman, producer, author, actress, and magazine publisher. Oprah's Milwaukee Christmas directly inspired her philanthropy, including a 2002 South African initiative she called Christmas Kindness. She and her staff traveled around the country with 50,000 presents for orphaned and impoverished young people. Rather than simply writing a check, she arranged to personally hand gifts to the children with their names on them.
I wanted to be able to look in each kid's face and say to that child, somebody remembered you.
Winfrey considered it the most rewarding experience of her life for deeply personal reasons. As she confided on her 2003 show.
And so it was my mission to do for them what the nuns had done for me. I called up the children one by one, and when those children, you know, received their gifts and then waited for the next child to receive their gifts, I said, nobody can open their presents until everybody can open their presents. And on the count of three, when I counted to three, and those children opened their presents, was the single greatest moment of my life.
And so does one kind act in 1966 Milwaukee echo through the ages. Happy holidays, everybody.
Writer Dean Robbins brought us that story on Oprah's Best Christmas, which took place in Milwaukee. Thanks to Harpo Inc. for the audio from The Oprah Winfrey Show. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, a new album from comedian Charlie Behrens and musician Adam Gruhl takes us on a tour of familiar Wisconsin themes. The beer, cheese, Midwest goodbyes, and some rivalries with neighboring states. Here's a song about that called Mitten State.
It's the debate of the true Mitten State. It's Wisconsin.
It's Michigan.
We'll always contemplate who has the better shape. It's the debate of Mitten State.
I am from Michigan and in Wisconsin now. I have an answer to that question. Maybe I'll share it later. Behrens and Gruhl join us now for a look at their new album, Dive Bar Dinner. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you listened to some of the tracks from the new album yet? Do you have a favorite song? Do you have questions for Behrens and Gruhl about their musical vision? Join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Adam Gruhl is a guitarist and vocalist for the band Horseshoes and Hand Grenades. Adam, thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's so nice to be with you. Thanks for having us on.
And Charlie Behrens is the comedian behind Manitowoc Minute. Charlie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me again. Appreciate you.
I want to start with the origins of this supergroup, power duo, whatever you want to call it. Charlie, let's start with you. You do, you know, stand-up. You do the Manitowoc Minute. We've talked to you about your book, The Midwest Survival Guide. What made you want to branch out into music?
You know, it's been something that I've enjoyed doing since I was a kid, and I met Adam, and he's been willing to teach me a lot about music and help me write and formulate songs. And we did one album in 2020, kind of all done thought, and this is kind of our second one. And it's really, I've just had a great time with it. I've had a lot of fun with it, so that's been my inspiration.
Now, Adam, you're a musician. Do you have qualms at the outset about working with a comedian that you might be doing novelty stuff? You know, we've got the rapid Rodney Dangerfield or disco Ray J. Johnson. Were you worried that you're going to end up in that kind of category here?
Well, man, I get a kick out of comedy in general. It's something I've always enjoyed. So, I mean, the short answer is no, I like it. You know, I like the juxtaposition of comedy and music. I think it has a propensity to bring people joy, which, I mean, in this day and age, there's a lot of things that bring people down. There's a lot of bummers. And to be able to create something that might make somebody laugh or make somebody feel nostalgic or just a little bit better, that's something that I really enjoy doing it, and I really, like, believe in.
And, Charlie, can you talk about, converting your views of Wisconsin and the uniqueness of the Midwest into lyrical form?
You know, it's always interesting. It's not really like writing a punchline, and it's not really like writing a video, but there are some similarities, you know, especially these days when you're trying to make music. Sometimes you try to like make a hook that'll go well on TikTok, or the sound can be replicated or used. And we threw a lot of that out on this because, you know, most of what I do is making those things. And so to just kind of make songs that we thought were super fun. And then if something organically goes, great, but we just wanted to write fun songs and kind of some songs with meaning and just some songs that are just funny.
Adam, in my head, I'm assuming Charlie's doing a lot of the lyrics, you're doing a lot of the music. Correct me if I'm wrong, but can you talk about putting the two together?
Well, but you know, believe it or not, it was really a mixture for both of us. You know, I wrote some lyrics for some of the songs and Charlie wrote some music for some of the other stuff. You know, when we kind of first became buddies, I think there was this kind of idea that Charlie would help, you know, teach me comedy and I would help teach Charlie music. And, you know, through this, it's been really interesting to watch Charlie develop, you know, like I would sometimes lay out a melody or chord structure and, you know, suddenly I'd get a call at 11:30 at night and Charlie would be all stoked because he finished the lyrics, or perhaps he wrote an additional like melodic piece. So really it was all over the spectrum there.
I want to get another taste of it here. Here's a clip from the song Keep Her Moving.
Milwaukee to Chicago, puddle jumping with 50 souls, and everyone I love is below me. Final stop, hey, I forget. So I fumble for my ticket, oh yeah.
first time in New Orleans. Slip me a sip of something strong. No beverage service on a flight this long. Cheaper moving.
Life is short. Charlie, tell us a little more about Keep Her Moving.
That was a song that originated. We were, I think, in Peoria or Rockford or something, yeah, doing a show. It was in the green room. There was a piano. And a lot of these songs actually were written in the green room. And Adam kind of had like the chord structure, similar to what you just heard there. And he was kind of just riffing some lyrics. And then I wrote a lot of those lyrics. And really what it was about is just kind of like, just kind of being on the road a lot and really just kind of missing home. And, you know, home for me is Milwaukee. So there are a lot of those elements in that song.
We are talking to Charlie Behrens and Adam Gruhl, the duo Behrens and Gruhl. They have a new album out called Dive Bar Dinner, a lot about life here in Wisconsin in the Midwest. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a fan of this band, their other bands or other performances as well, join in at 800-642-1234. Enjoy the conversation coming up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Adam Gruhl from the band Horseshoes and Hand Grenades and Charlie Behrens from Manitowoc Minute. They have a band. They have their second album out. The band is Behrens and Gruhl. The album, Dive Bar Dinner. Let's go to your calls at 800-642-1234. Michael is with us in Northeast Wisconsin. Michael, hi.
Hi. I saw the video for this last time and thought it was just another joke. Now I didn't know it was real. And the main thing is I wanted to thank Charlie for teaching me that I did OOP, something I've been doing my whole life. Other people say oops, and we say OOP up north.
It's not just you, Michael. I had the same thing. Like, I kept seeing the OOP thing, and I'm like, I don't say OOP. And then I caught myself, you know, getting around somebody there, and I said OOP. And I was like, I guess I do. Charlie, you hear this all the time, Charlie.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, really, OOP is one of those things that I heard my dad say it a lot growing up, and it was kind of, you know, parodying him with my brothers. And then, I thought everyone kind of knew about it to a degree. And then I put it in a video with Miles, the School of OOP, and it just kind of took off. So we've been kind of making a bigger joke about it since, but I'm glad that you know that it's a real album now. I think that was actually, that's the sort of the hard part about promoting this is I make so many jokes and so many parodies that when I do something actually about an album, I think people aren't actually sure what I'm talking about. So I got to work on that for my whole marketing capacity. But
the new album is actual. It's real. Adam, it I wanted is. To ask you about, does working with Charlie here let you do something, express yourself musically or lyrically in a way that, is different from what you might do in Horseshoes and Hand Grenades or your other projects?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think Charlie and I at the core are good pals. And when we started working on this record, you'd think that we would try to, do a juxtaposition of bluegrass and comedy or, Americana and comedy. And what really happened was, I'm happy about this. What really happened was we kind of just let the music take itself, where it wanted to go. We were be in the green room and we'd be discussing things going on in life, and maybe that would turn into a song. And so really the album, it certainly got some comedy to it, but it also has like a songs that are kind of reflective of the broad spectrum of human emotions, a broad spectrum of the kind of human condition, the human experience.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Liz is with us in Lyons. Liz, hello.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Liz?
I just wanted to thank Charlie for teaching me about Yep, No, Yep through his videos. My fiance, Brian, is going to be very jealous that I'm talking to him on the phone right now. He is from Wisconsin. I am from Georgia. And so I had to figure out, you helped me figure out, yep, no, yep. And I just find your videos very funny. And my fiance, Brian, just loves everything that you do.
Have you, you're from Georgia, yeah. You said, Liz, have you learned to be Wisconsin from in part from Charlie?
Oh, yeah.
Liz, thanks a lot for the call. And you actually wrote a book, Charlie, The Midwest Survival Guide, to help, I mean, in part, to help people like Liz acclimate to life here in the Midwest.
Yeah, and Liz, you got to tell Brian I says hi. And, that's it right there. It's what you end on, you know. It's like, that means no, no, that means no, that's a and definitely, maybe, I suppose. I don't know. That's, you know, you just don't really know. So, honestly, if you just look at the last word, that's what we really mean, you know. Liz, or no.
Or, yeah. No, no, yeah. Liz, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. I want to give another listen to one of the songs from Dive Bar Dinner now. This is one we've talked on the air about, Charlie. Midwest Goodbye.
What do you mean you're leaving? You guys just got here about, like, an hour ago. Oh, I guess it has been 5 hours, hasn't it? Well, before you go, let me make sure you got some leftovers. Oh, you got the leftovers? Did you get the brats, though? Them are good brats. Hungarians, I got them down the road. Yeah, they're spicy now. They might keep you up if you have some, so let me set you up with some Tums before you go, okay? Here, I know I got some around here somewhere.
Adam, is this something that, like, when you're working with Charlie, do you guys end up doing the Midwest Goodbye? Like, we're trying to get out of the studio here, but...
I mean, not necessarily in the studio, but it is a frequent issue in being a pal of Charlie. I think every place you go, it turns into a Midwest Goodbye.
Oh, okay. Don't being a pal. This is Adam at the bar. Well, it's 11:30. We got an early morning. Should we whack another beer and see if we can find karaoke somewhere? That'd be fun. Adam's whole life is a Midwest Goodbye, so I don't need that put on to me at all.
Oh, boy, we only got like 4 minutes left here, guys. Should we start saying goodbye now? No, we can take another caller. We'll say hello instead. Richard is with us in Two Rivers. Hello, Richard.
Yeah, hey. I want to ask Charlie. I've seen him in Manitowoc. He was brilliant. But what's the difference between... going local and going mainstream, and what's his obstacles?
Richard, thanks for the call. I don't know. Do you consider yourself local or mainstream, or do you care about the difference, Charlie?
You know, it's really interesting. I mean, it's a very good question. Because these days, the way sort of the media landscape is, if you will, if you have an audience, it doesn't really matter. I mean, we've done shows in Hawaii, in London, in New York. And down south, Phoenix, Florida, you know, the thing about Midwesterners is they tend to leave and want to find each other again. And that you can see that with Packers bars popping up all over the place, or euchre tournaments or whatever. So honestly, when I do a show outside of the Midwest, it's a very similar audience. Now, there are times when I'm doing someone else's show or whatever, and I just set up the jokes differently so more people can understand them. But really, at the end of the day, a lot of the stuff in the Midwest is fairly universal. It's, you know, things with your family or relationship type stuff. And there's a way to make it all universal.
Thanks a lot for the call, Richard. And the live show reminds me, Adam, what kind of touring are you doing in support of Dive Bar Dinner? Are you doing a, no pun intended, grueling tour, or just a show here and there?
Yeah, so I do hit the road with Charlie, I'd say quite frequently. You know, I have an interesting chore of balancing. I think I'm in four or five different projects, Horseshoes and Hand Grenades, a rock band called the High Hawks, a duo with Sarah Voss from Dead Horses called Rucksack Revolution, and kind of my own band called Adam Gruhl and the Space Burritos that actually are the backing band for the Dive Bar Dinner album. So anyhow, it's a balancing act, and I sure have a heck of a lot of fun going on the road with Charlie, and I get to do some stand-up stuff to kick off the night in addition to some music, and of course that's largely influenced by getting to learn from Charlie.
All right, I got two words for you guys. Rock opera. What do you think, Charlie? A Charlie Barron's Manitowoc Minute, Barron's and Gruhl storytelling rock opera.
We've been talking about that.
No way.
Midwest the Musical. So we haven't gone full rock opera with it, but I honestly love that, or I always have, like, those sort of Broadway type shows. And like, I don't know, you know, you see like the Guys on Ice thing, and they've been able to run that show for a while. It's just another medium that we haven't really gone into yet. But the last song, talk about the last song.
Yeah, there's this song Tornado that kind of was part of this conversation about Midwest the Musical. It's kind of a, you know, it has a theatrical feel to it, with kind of just a goofy storyline. There's a lot of places you can take music and comedy. So I guess we're both excited to see where these roads can kind of lead.
Well, we'll leave it there. Adam and Charlie, thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thank you, and thanks to all the callers. It was really nice chit-chatting with folks.
Love this show. I love listening to it. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, well, I know you guys are busy, so I'll let you hit the road there. Watch out for deer.
Okay. Well, we got a casserole for you if you want to hang on.
I'll be over.
Just one more chit-chat.
Say hi to your folks.
How about one more call?
Let's whack one more beer, you know?
We've been talking and are still talking with Adam Gruhl, guitarist and vocalist for the band Horseshoes and Hand Grenades and many others, and Charlie Behrens with Manitowoc Minute, and their new album as Behrens and Gruhl is called Dive Bar Dinner. We'll get a link up to some of their tracks. Find that at WPR.org/Central Time. Stick around. There's more to come. Tomorrow on Central Time, would you eat lab-grown meat? We'll look at the latest in the developing food technology and what could be on its way to a grocery store near you. You can get that conversation started right now. If you're a vegetarian, would you want something grown from animal cells? Would that count? If you eat meat, would you want something grown in a lab? Let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, there's been a rise in book bans across the country. An expert from PEN America shares what they learned about book bans from a 2-year study. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Last week, the nonprofit organization PEN America released a new report about book bans in schools, with data collected across the United States from July 2021 through June of this year. The findings show that book bans and challenges are on the rise around the country, with certain authors and topics being targeted more than others. Our next guest worked on that report. She joins us now for a look at the results and what it all means for free expression and access to books in schools. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you encountered a certain book or group of books being challenged or removed from your kid's school? Have you made a book challenge yourself? If you work as a teacher or school librarian, have you seen more of these kind of things coming up? What questions do you have about how this works and why there's been more of it coming up lately? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Casey Meehan is the program director of Freedom to Read at PEN America. Casey, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
For the purposes of this new report titled Spineless Shelves, 2 Years of Book Banning, what counts as a book ban as opposed to maybe a challenge or other way of bringing a book up in a school?
Yeah, so PEN America defines a school book ban as any action taken against a book based on its content and as a result of a parent or community challenge, administrative decision, or in response to direct or threatened action by lawmakers that leads to a previously accessible book being either completely removed from students or where that access is restricted or diminished. So to say it much more succinctly, we count any book as a banned book when a book that was previously available is no longer available to students, or that book's access has been, you know, significantly diminished.
This issue has come up in high-profile cases in certain states, some school board meetings. Big picture trends, though, it looks like these kind of challenges that end up removing books one way or another, they're going up lately?
Yeah. So part of why we wanted to look at the scope of the last 2 years is we have been, Penn America started tracking instances of school book bans in 2021. From 2021 to the next school year, the 2022 to 2023 school year, we saw, you know, a mounting rise in book bans. And that trend is, you know, illuminated when we look at the 2 years, the full 2 years, where we have recorded nearly 6,000 instances of books across 41 states and nearly 300 public schools were removed.
There could be a secondary effect here where a teacher or school district doesn't end up bringing a book in the first place for fear of challenges. Do you worry about sort of hidden bans in effect because people worry that certain books would be challenged?
Absolutely. We point to the chilling effect that this movement is having. And there's many ways that the chilling effect is kind of creeping across public schools. So it may be that educators are thinking more cautiously about what books they want to bring into their own classrooms. We've also heard from many districts that school library book purchases have just been suspended while districts and administrators and librarians kind of wait out this current movement to censor books and to remove books from classroom and school libraries. So there's many ways that we're seeing, you know, the chilling effect, censor and encourage individuals to self-censor and also lead to other forms of censorship playing out in public schools.
Is it always necessarily bad if a book is challenged or removed? We can imagine, you know, straight up pornographic books. I think few people would make a case that those should be on a middle school shelf, say. Are there cases where, maybe not going that far, but there might be explicit sexual descriptions in a book and people say, you know what, this isn't what we want in our schools?
I'm going to start with this idea that there's pornographic material in schools. I think this is something that, you know, Penn America has often tried to debunk. Mm. It is one of those myths. It is a very, you know, provocative statement that's, you know, shared and is leading to much of the book banning. But we have, you know, there are professionals that have always had the responsibility of curating book collections for students in school libraries, and certainly educators have lots of training on what is and is not, you know, developmentally appropriate for students in their classroom. So, you know, in some ways there's always been sensible systems in place to allow for those educators and librarians and district leaders to make good decisions for their students. And the second half of this is that they're, of course, like, you know, parents have always had a voice in their students' education and should have a voice in their students' education. And traditionally, there are many ways in which, you know, individual parents may object or have a deeper conversation with their student's educator as to why a certain book was included in a reading list or accessible in a classroom. But what we see happening is slightly more escalated than that. It's a real coordinated effort where school districts are being challenged by advocacy groups or by individual activists that have, you know, the aim of removing hundreds of books. We also see this increasingly an introduction of legislation that is also, you know, kind of putting like these blanket bans on the types of books and types of content that are accessible and allowable in schools. So there's lots of, I know there's a lot in there, but I think, you know, just important context to raise.
Talking to Casey Meehan, Program Director of Freedom to Read at Penn America, looking at book challenges and book bans at schools. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your thoughts on this. Maybe something you've seen come up in your own community. Join in at 800-642-1234. Casey, the new report tracks what kinds of books are being challenged. What kind of trends did you see?
So we have seen, you know, again, kind of over the last 2 years, some shifting trends, but also some consistent trends. One of the things that we point to is when we look at the content of the book. So not necessarily, you know, we're not pointing to why a book was challenged or like the rationale behind a book being banned, but the actual content of the book. What we see overwhelmingly is books banned include characters of color or talk about race and racism. They include LGBTQ+ characters or talk about and discuss themes of sex and sexuality. And increasingly, we see many books that are banned include themes of or instances of violence, and some of that includes physical abuse and sexual assault as well. So those are some of the bigger thematic areas that are overwhelmingly featured in books that have been banned.
You talk about in the report copycat bans. So what kind of things are you seeing when one thing comes up in one school? How does that then spread?
Yeah, so we have seen, you know, again, the way in which, and we point to the coordinated movement here, and I think copycat bans is a good example of that. So if you see, you know, oftentimes a book that's banned in one district will then be, you know, challenged to be banned in several other districts within a state, but also across state lines. So, you know, sort of having that the first time a book is challenged and then banned has a ripple effect of it being challenged and banned in other places. And we point to a few examples of this, including Sold, which is a book by Patricia McCormick. It was banned in 7 districts in the first school year we started tracking, the 2021 to 2022 school year. But then the following school year, we recorded 24 districts that had removed Sold from access, bringing the total to 31 bans over the 2 years. So the way in which, you know, once you're kind of identified as a book that is, you know, for whatever reason is being banned in a given context, then we see it copycatted and mirrored in other districts.
You also look at school policies surrounding these challenges. And there was one case here in Wisconsin, the Elkhorn Area School District, where one parent filed a complaint about 444 different titles in the middle and high school levels. The school's procedure there is those then apparently come off the shelf while the review process is going on. Books including some of the ones you've mentioned, but also like Anna Karenina by Leo Tolstoy. Mm. The expectation is that most of them will end up back on the shelves, probably all of them maybe, but in the meantime, they're not on the shelves. And I understand the district is going to review how they handle that. Your thoughts on how schools handle these kind of requests in the first place?
Yeah, I mean, we have seen this kind of district policy, but also states enact similar policy, where as soon as a book is challenged, it automatically gets removed. You know, oftentimes we will point to the fact that that's against any sort of procedural best practice, which is to keep the book available while it goes through a reconsideration process. And the other piece we often point to is, you know, we will call these types of bans banned pending review. And we count them in this way because, as you just pointed to, you know, over 400 books in the school district in Wisconsin have been removed from access for students. And this process may take a month. We have seen review processes in other parts of the country take upwards of a year, even more than a year. So that's a long time to have, you know, very highly restricted and or diminished access to a pretty significant number of books.
Casey Meehan is with us, Program Director of Freedom to Read at PEN America, with us to talk about the group's new report looking at 2 years of data about book bans in schools and school libraries across the United States. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you ever read a book in school that touched on sensitive topics or presented a different worldview than what you were used to? What was that experience like? Were you glad that book was available? And are these issues, book banning, that have come up in your own community lately? Tell us about it. Join in at 800-642-1234. Love to hear the perspectives of parents, teachers, school librarians, students. 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Casey Meehan from PEN America about a new report on the state of book bans over the past couple of years, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a parent, do you feel okay about how your school handles the content, the books that are available in classrooms, in school libraries, on the reading list for a particular class? Have you ever encountered, as a teacher, a school administrator, a parent, or student, a challenged book? How did it all work out? Join in with your thoughts, questions, and experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Marcus is with us in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hi, Rob. So when I was in high school, my father was he was on the school board in Wauwatosa. When I graduated, he was the president of the school board, and they faced numerous issues of this sort. I think back to when I was in middle school reading Huckleberry Finn, Tom Sawyer. I'm a white male. I have multiracial children. I realize that the language that's used in those books is wholly inappropriate for quite some time, but it's certainly definitely in today's society. One thing that my father pointed out to me when I was a kid, he said that if you ban these types of books, though, you will forget where we came from. And if we can't remember where we came from, how will we ever know where we're going? And so I don't think banning is the right way to go. I think putting them into context, making other resources available to provide context and other further understandings as society has evolved, I think would be far more beneficial than just outright banning books. That's what got the Nazis into power, and it caused a lot of problems for a lot of people.
Marcus, thanks for the call. Casey, I'm not sure how they turn up in the new report. I know Mark Twain books have been challenged in the past. Marcus's thoughts on, hey, we give educational context to the books we read. Your thoughts on what he had to say?
Yeah, I think, Marcus and I agree in that. I think this current wave that we're watching of censorship is not necessarily coming for a book like Huckleberry Finn. But that certainly we have had many moments in the U.S. history where Huckleberry Finn has been challenged for its, for the racial tropes and the use of the N-word. And I think that's exactly right. Rather than banning it, removing it, putting it, tucking it away and acting like this book was never written, how can we better contextualize, inform, educate, within the context of the book and the larger context in which and when and where that book was written?
Marcus, thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. Joy joins us now in West Bend. Joy, hi.
Hi. I am calling to ask how many times when something is banned, a book, a movie, or whatever, will the young people look for the access to that item on the internet or in another way?
Joy, thanks for the call, Casey. I have heard this argument that actually banning something may make it more interesting to young people.
Yeah, I mean, it's possible, but I think what we we kind of our guiding light, the thing that we ground ourselves in, is that school libraries, classroom libraries, schools are places for students to have access to a diverse diverse access to books and literature that introduces new ideas, new identities, new cultures, new experiences. So to remove books in that context, remove books from schools. It's hard. Sure, students can go elsewhere, but not all students have the same access and opportunity to go find and access, these critical resources elsewhere, which is why, school libraries are just so essential.
Yeah, I wanted to bring that up. I don't think Joy was making this argument, but it has been argued. I think in courts, when these kind of challenges have gone to the courts, there's been an argument saying it's okay if they're not in the school libraries because they're accessible online or at booksellers. And as I understand it from your report, courts haven't really smiled on that argument.
That's right. And, you can be banned from one place, but permissible in another place, right? So, to remove and to prohibit books in schools is still a ban. It's still a diminished, access. And, the way in which we see, again, a coordinated, ideologically driven effort to remove certain types of books makes this particularly alarming.
Thanks for that call, Joy, at 800-642-1234. Talking to Casey Meehan, Program Director of Freedom to Read at PEN America, looking at a new report from the group looking at book bans in schools around the country. Casey, I want to talk a little more about the process now. What kind of processes are you hoping schools have in place before the book challenge or the 400 book challenges roll in?
Yeah, I mean, district policy, as we already pointed to, is so important. So having a really strong reconsideration policy, already designed that, may follow some procedural best practices from groups like ALA and NCAC to keep a book available while it undergoes review, and to have a review committee that includes, parents and educators and librarians and maybe, a district administrator, but having an inclusive review committee to fully read a book and then make an assessment of that book based on its literary and artistic merits. I mean, that's sort of it's close to that's the golden standard here. But what's happening, of course, is that in addition to individuals and groups challenging books, we are also seeing the introduction of legislation. This is true in Wisconsin as well, that is changing the game of how book challenges are or book bans are occurring. I mean, with the introduction of legislation, we're seeing, you know, in some ways a shift away from actually having books challenged to just these blanket bans on books that include, you know, certain identities or include content and themes based on legislation.
Point toward states where you've seen the most action when it comes to that kind of legislation and talk about the impact that's had in those states.
Sure. I mean, you know, everyone points to Florida, so I guess I can start there. But we have seen several pieces of legislation in Florida that have, you know, in some ways really influenced Florida being on the top of our list as a state that is banning, you know, more books than any other state. So we see this in Florida, but we also see legislation in Iowa having an effect on pulling books from classrooms. And again, often without an individual challenge to a book, but they're being removed under, you know, out of caution because of, you know, in an attempt to be in compliant with state legislation.
And what kind of things are you worried about here in Wisconsin? We have a legislature that may have advanced some of these laws, a governor opposed to some of these changes. Are there things in the future that you're worried about here in the state?
Yeah. So, I mean, certainly we are tracking, you know, most states at this point where we do see, you know, either local efforts to remove books that include, you know, kind of advocacy groups or individuals putting a lot of pressure on their local school district, as well as, you know, the introduction of legislation. And both those things are playing out in Wisconsin. In our cumulative report, we do demonstrate that there have been 72 book bans in Wisconsin that we've recorded to date over 10 school districts. And we are also following the legislative session where we're seeing laws or, you know, legislation being introduced again under this larger rhetoric of parental rights that likely will have implications on the types of books and the process of which books are challenged and removed from schools.
I wonder if you have thoughts for a parent who might be listening, saying, you know, there are some books I don't think my kid is ready for one reason or another, or I'm not ready for them to encounter certain things based on our family's values. I don't want to take it off the shelf, you know, for everybody. But do you have thoughts on that parent, how they can work with their school district on an issue like that?
Absolutely. And I think you touch on it. You know, a parent should have you know, lots of oversight for their student and lots of, you know, contributions to their student's educational process. But that doesn't mean making unilateral decisions that affect all students and all parents in that district or in a state. So certainly, you know, if you as a parent are engaging with some of the material that your student is engaging and you're not sure, have a conversation with your educator, have a conversation with the librarians in your community or in your school. And likely there are already sensible systems in place, as I shared earlier, that, you know, can help a parent and a student navigate what is not appropriate for them.
And looking toward the future, Casey, this report looks back over the last couple of years. What do you have your eyes on as we enter 2024?
Oh, you know, I think as much as we, you know, I'll say two things. We certainly see the way in which the trend is increasing. You know, we are counting instances of book bans every day in the hundreds and thousands. It's quite alarming, the way in which more and more books are being swept from access. And, you know, efforts to oppose book banning is also growing. So where we see individuals looking to ban a book, we certainly see, you know, groups and individuals looking to uphold the freedom to read and really looking to defend access to diverse and inclusive books in our school and public libraries. So, you know, I think I have a lot of optimism around kind of those counter efforts getting stronger, getting more unified, getting clearer in our message that all students deserve access to school libraries, to classroom libraries that are filled with books that represent themselves, that introduce them, you know, introduce students to new ideas and identities and experiences and you know, continue to serve that our pluralistic society really at its core.
Casey, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Casey Meehan is the program director of Freedom to Read at PEN America. We've been talking about a new report from the group that looks at the recent uptick in book banning at schools. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.